some of the big issues that are really driving our public safety budget. So today is all about long-term thinking. Now, fortunately, in this budget cycle, we're not going to have to think about our next prison. We have a bit of a reprieve. So we can all take a deep breath and try to think now long-term about whether or not we're getting the best bang for our public safety dollar. And that's what today is all about, getting the best bang for our public safety dollar. To help inform the decisions that we have to make, we have some experts with us. First will be Max Williams, the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, who will be reporting on kind of the big picture of the Department of Corrections and some of the challenges we face over the long term. We'll also have Steve Aos of the Washington Institute for Public Policy, who's done some very innovative work on cost-benefit analysis, as well as Craig Prinz and Mike Wilson from the Criminal Justice Commission, who will take some of the ideas that Mr. Aos has come up with and apply them to the Oregon condition and situation. Then also I'm pleased to have with us from Portland State University Dr. Brian Renauer and Dr. Annette Jolin, who I've asked to come and do some research, even though it's really not their exact area of expertise, just to try to do a scan of what some other states are doing on the issue of sentencing. So today let's think long term, and today is all about trying to figure out how to best protect our communities over that long term. So with that, Mr. Williams, could you please come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Max Williams, Director, Department of Corrections. It's my pleasure to have an opportunity again to spend a couple of minutes with the committee this afternoon to provide you some additional overview information on the department and to respond specifically to some questions that were posed by the chairman that he would like us to address today. I hope you have in front of you an overview document from me. I wasn't aware that we were in the fancier room today, or I would have gone ahead and put it up on the screen, but if you just follow through with me on your slides, I think we can walk through this relatively quickly. I understand I have about 10 minutes, and you've got some people who are visiting who have some information that I really think is worthy of your consideration, and you can have me to kick around pretty much any time you want, so I'm happy to abbreviate my remarks as much as I possibly can. The chair asked four specific things that he would want us to demonstrate in the material we're providing you today, and one is some idea about the time and construction and the impact of debt service on the prison system, the growth trajectory and its impact on the department, the impact of Measure 11 on DOC's budget, and then the overall mix of services being funded in our public safety budget here in Oregon. And I just start, if you turn to that first slide on Oregon's prisons, that gives you an outline of the prisons that we're currently operating or that are under construction in Oregon. The area that is shaded in gray are those which we are currently paying ongoing debt service on. So those prisons were either constructed using COP funds, certificates of participation, or we have done some expansion or enhancement of those facilities using certificate of participation funds for which we're continuing to pay debt service. The next slide you'll see is a history of DOC growth dating back to 1985. Some of you have obviously seen this graph, this graphic representation before. I think this one is helpful in part because it gives you a sense of the timing of some significant policy changes with respect to prisons and incarceration and the use of different methodologies over time and how that impacted it. And obviously, sentencing guidelines, as we had talked about in the presentation last week, begin to have an impact, forcing the department and the state to have to acquire new prison facilities and to construct new bed space. You see the impact of Measure 11 and then also the somewhat offsetting short-term impact of Senate Bill 1145 and local control when the decision was made to keep those who were convicted of a felony for 12 months or less in their community and the impact that that had and then the ongoing trajectory following that. The dotted line as you get to the top of that graph, obviously, is the future forecast, and I've got a graph in the book that, or in your presentation that will show you some more detail on that point. The third slide that I wanted to demonstrate really gets into the issues of debt service. for the department. This slide has three lines on it that gives you a sense of where the department is with respect to debt service. And what you see in that the middle, if you focus on the middle kind of grayish line with the triangle markings, that is our current debt service trajectory for the department. So that shows you essentially the current balance spread out over the payback period. The black diamond line above that is essentially those sales that are either projected for 2007 related to the ongoing construction at Deer Ridge and the startup costs, but also includes about $42 million that we're anticipating funding in the governor's recommended budget for our deferred maintenance package that was approved by the governor for inclusion in the budget, and the $10 million or so that's associated with the design work associated with the construction of the next facility. So that gives you a little bit of what that change in trajectory would be as we move forward into the new year. And then the small line on the bottom just gives you sort of the biennial impact of the actual debt service amounts and how that ultimately begins to decline as you get out somewhere in the neighborhood of about, another 10 or 12 years. And that's assuming, again, no additional construction beyond that point. That's using current values. That next slide just, again, shows you a sense of as the policy choices changed, the number of facilities and expansions increased, particularly in the 90s forward. And the slide following that gives you a more specific reference to the actual outstanding amounts for debt service. So you can actually see the individual sales reflected, what the amount of the sale was, and then the outstanding balance. And as you can see there, we have slightly more than $1 billion currently tied to those sales. Not all of them are for construction of new prison facilities. You'll note some of those are associated with Senate Bill 1145, jail expansions or constructions. But that gives you a sense of the current outstanding amount of debt service relative to the Department of Corrections. The next three slides really were some efforts to try to provide the committee some information about comparisons of debt service growth. You'll see the first one is in all funds, both other fund and general fund funded statewide for all agencies, 1995-97 as compared to 2007-09. And that small little sliver and then the little bit larger sliver between those two graphs reflects the Department of Corrections. In 95-97, before we had really hit full stride in the prison construction phases, if you go back and look at that chronological chart, the department was less than 1% of the all funds amount of debt service, reflected obviously in the 2007-09, our debt service amount is approximately 4% of all debt service statewide. The next slide gives you that same kind of breakdown, but now we've moved from an all funds budget to a general fund budget. There are a number of agencies that have acquired debt service over time in the state that are other funds funded agencies and therefore have those other funds to use to pay off those debt loads. There are fewer state agencies that are general fund funded that have that large debt service imposition, and this again reflects that. In 95-97, just for the general fund side, corrections made up 44.6%. If you look at 07-09, as in the governor's recommended budget, we've grown to 53.5% of the overall general fund amount in the state budget being dedicated towards the repayment of these COPs. And then finally, with respect to debt service, in the last slide, on slide 9, you have a compared to total DOC general fund. In 95-97, debt service was 4.3% of the department's overall budget, and today it's 10.3%. Again, in dealing with the population growth and the expansion of the system. So it was hopeful that those three slides would give you some sense of perspective in the growth of debt service over time as the department has moved forward with its construction and expansion efforts since the early 1990s. Slide 10 is a slide that we'll probably share with you several more times before it's over, and you could probably stand up and talk about it as effectively as I. But this is the slide prepared by the Office of Economic Analysis, and it reflects the current projections of prison growth from where we are and where we were in 2004 out to 2016. And as you can see, we continue to grow. And we continue to grow at a fairly good rate. What you'll see from the diamond line above it is where the projections were in October of 2004 from the 2004 forecast. And so, as the chair pointed out, that moderation in the forecast is reflected as the difference between those two graphs really reflects this opportunity we have to not be in this session asking for the construction of a new facility immediately, but to have a little bit of time to plan and push that startup time for the new construction of the facility off by a biennium. But it does reflect, obviously, an ongoing growth and an ongoing need to continue to build new facilities as we project over time. And this next slide on slide number 11 reflects some of that same conversation. One of the specific questions we were asked to address today was the impact of ballot measure 11 on the Oregon correction system. This slide, which is euphemistically referred to both by us and the forecast office as the whale, and if you squint a little bit, it kind of looks like a whale. This slide reflects essentially the impact of Measure 11 in our system, both historically and then what is currently forecasted under the October 2006 forecast, both the direct and the indirect impact. And you can see that it continues to project that over time, by the end of 2015, well more than 5,500 inmates inside the system would have been directly in the system, and those beds would be as a result directly of Measure 11. And I think it's important to understand the impact of that slide just briefly to say what we're measuring there is not how many people were convicted of a Measure 11 offense. The forecast attempts to actually figure out how many additional beds are a direct result as the individuals begin to stack for longer sentences, more beds are ultimately required to address that. Every one of these people was going to come to prison for some period of time. This slide attempts to capture what the impact is of those additional bed days driven by the impact of that law change. So it's an important distinction, but it's one that you need to sort of keep in your mind as you evaluate the data, which takes us to slide number 12. And on slide 12, we were trying to come up with a way to respond to the request to demonstrate a fiscal impact as it relates to Measure 11. And there are many ways to sort of slice that pie. But the way that we thought was probably most effective was to simply use those increased bed days driven directly from the prison population forecast and assign to it our costs associated with the operations of the facility, security, direct care, and program services. And that's what you have in that slide. So this slide does not reflect debt service. It doesn't reflect community grants through the community correction system, the construction funds, administration, or central functions. But it does reflect the direct services inside the institutions and the impact of Measure 11. And you'll see that 28% of our total operations budget is defined by this slide are going to those Measure 11 additional beds, essentially, those offender beds. So that's essentially one way to look at it. Similarly, if you went back to that last slide, and it shows that somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 or near 4,000 offenders, and we have about 13,000 in the system, there's a rough approximation to that number as well that gets fairly close to a quarter. So a couple of different ways to sort of see that impact. Finally, I'll just make a brief comment as it relates to how the resources are currently being used within the system. This first slide on 13 is, again, the entire public safety budget divided up by the various categories. And you'll see the direct DOC amount at 65%, not including the community corrections pass-through dollars that are also part of our budget, but we've broken out here separately. And then you can see the other areas within the system from the Criminal Justice Commission reflected there down through state police and the Oregon Youth Authority. This is a helpful graph, I think, if only just to understand in the great pie. And as Mr. Wilson pointed out recently in that last presentation, what we reflect here in this graph is the executive branch. Obviously the judicial branch is a significant part of the system, and their funds are not reflected on this particular graph for the judicial branch. And then the next slide is the one where I finally kind of want to just make a closing comment. This is essentially how then inside the Department of Corrections These funds are broken down by division. The funds that the lion's share, obviously, are our operations division, which relates to the day-to-day operations of those institutions where the 13,300 and some odd offenders are currently housed. You can see the community corrections money is the next largest chunk, and then debt service. And the part that I've had sort of pulled out in the pie there for transitional services and that community corrections money, those monies combined are really the state's investment at some level in the issues involving reentry, the transition back to community from prison, and our treatment and education dollars, the monies that are really designed to meet the other part of the department's mission, which is trying to change criminal behavior in a way that doesn't create new victims. And you can tell that over the years, the disinvestment in those kinds of programs, given the state's tough fiscal situation and the resources, have made those places just not as necessary for investment as we try to balance the budget. But I can assure you that to the extent that we have been able to demonstrate a decline in recidivism and invest in those areas, these are the places where I think you get the biggest bang for your buck. Our opportunity to invest in those kinds of transition-related programs, in treatment, and in education does have a significant impact on changing individual behaviors as this 97% of our population ultimately moves back into the community. And I really encourage you, as you have the opportunity to watch the presentation from Mr. Prinz and Mr. Ose from Washington, some of the portfolio concepts of how we can invest in both prevention, in treatment, and the work that we do with these offenders as they release back into community is really significant and a place that I really encourage the committee to pay some attention to. So with that, Mr. Chairman, knowing that I've probably gone over my time, I'm happy to take any questions if you'd like, or I'm happy to just hold any questions you might have and respond to the committee at another time.
Why don't we have a couple of questions before we move on, Representative Dickens?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly understand that it is a very responsible thing to do. I'm referring to slide 12 now, the impact of Measure 11, fiscal impact. It's very responsible to report the hard numbers of exactly what the impact would be, the additional security, direct care, and services for the additional person days or whatever the right unit of measurement is. However, in thinking about full cost accounting, there is an additional impact on the size of the facility and the management of the facility. So if you do you have a number for us now, or do you have sort of like a ballpark number or an educated guess? If you included all those other things that are impacted, it would be something larger than this number. But how much larger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nathanson, it would be obviously something larger than that number. And I think the difficulty is as you get down to sort of this next layer of slicing this discussion beyond those direct services at sort of the administration level and then the construction level and those other, you know, even the community grant level, it becomes slightly more complicated to calculate in a way that we were comfortable just giving the committee a number today. There are a couple of different ways we can approach it, and would be happy to actually talk to Mr. Wilson about maybe coming up with a strategy that would be satisfactory to the committee. We could certainly do some rough pro rata sort of things, and I'm always a little nervous about that because of its inaccuracy or its ability to skew, but we'll be happy to take a cut at it and provide both the chair and Mr. Wilson a couple of options, and when we come back to present our full budget, be willing to provide you that information, or sooner if you'd prefer.
A short follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
Yes, presenting that to us after you have a few hours or days to think about it would be just fine. And I do appreciate that there's a distinction in how you might try to estimate those costs. For example, for each extra person day, you don't add a 0.0001 of a person in administration.
Right.
You reach a certain level and then you ramp up.
Yeah, then it's stair steps.
Step effect.
That's exactly
so I
right.
do understand that there's that and some other sorts of considerations, but an estimate would be appreciated.
Thank you. We'll work on something with Mr. Wilson and try to get back to you, Representative.
Any other questions?
have one or two more. Max, the next prison, I wanted to ask you about that. I've heard that that's going to, after COPs and the whole, the whole thing is paid off, could cost over $600 million. Do you have any sense of if that's a correct number? Or
I saw that number in the in an article in the Register Guard over the weekend, and it was a number that I can't say it's a wrong number. I don't know that I have an exact number. I have estimated that the base cost of probably the next facility, given that Madras, we're currently building Deer Ridge, at about $190 million for that facility. And that was based on a construction commitment that the legislature, I think, approved for us in 2001. So we're almost 6 years off of the numbers. And with some assumed rate of inflation for construction resources, which is pretty common in the industry, I believe that it's highly likely that an estimate on Deer Ridge would come in somewhere in the, on the next facility would come in somewhere in the neighborhood of $250 million. And that really is a ballpark estimate, just knowing what we know about the facility we built, applying some really rough inflationary rates for construction, and recognizing that that facility is one that's going to have to deal with some special population needs, and we anticipate that it would likely be a more expensive facility to construct, knowing that. If you took that number and you then spread it out over 30 years like you do any mortgage, you know, even in our private lives, the price you pay often for that home on a 30-year mortgage isn't the price that was on the real estate's person's flyer when you sign those papers, but it's whatever that plus the interest cost is over the life of that loan. And you know, as you can see, you know, the debt service payback period in these slides, you know, is a long one, and I would suspect that, you know, you'll pay probably close to twice the value of the construction cost of that facility. And I'm going to look at my my banker to make sure that I'm about right. Am I right? Okay, good. So okay. I got the nod from my I should introduce, this is Mr. Nathan Allen, who's the Budget and Planning Administrator for the Department of Corrections, and I euphemistically refer to him as my banker, but yes, I look for him to answer those questions.
So about $500 million?
Yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood, I would assume.
And then the last one, I don't want to put you on the spot too difficultly at this point, but in the past you'd mentioned that we're on an unsustainable trajectory, and I know with the kind of the leveling off of the prison population growth, that might not be as correct as it was before.
As unsustainable as it was, it might be
less unsustainable.
Less unsustainable. Let me give the context to that statement that I have made. Coming out of the 2003 legislative session and having lived through the period of time between 2001 and 2003 when we were in such a difficult time during the special sessions to balance the budget, and then viewing the public's willingness to engage in additional revenue conversations and the growth cycle that the department was on at the time, it seemed as though if we were going to try to maintain the balance of relationships between the various major boxes of state spending, between how much we were spending on education, how much we were spending on human services, and how much we were spending on public safety, that we were growing at a rate that you could not sustain that same level of service delivery without either increasing the overall size of the pie by additional revenue or deciding that you were going to start carving out portions of those funds from other major components of the general fund budget. As a general fund agency, there are really only two other major pies, and that's education, as you well know, and human services. And so the context of that statement about the unsustainable trajectory was, in fact, that if the pie didn't start to increase, the sustainability of being able to grow the Department of Corrections at the rate it was growing was going to be a very challenging issue as we confronted those issues with those other agencies within the general fund budget. We have been blessed by a moderation in the forecast. At the same time, we've been blessed by an improving revenue picture throughout the state and an increased set of resources. That being said, you know, we are still talking about the need to get authorization for the design of a new facility this biennium and the full build construction under the current forecast in the next biennium. And the operational costs typically of a facility surpass the construction costs after three biennia. And I want to repeat that again. The operational costs surpass the construction costs after three biennia. So it usually, by your third full operation of a facility, you have now spent more in operating that facility than you did in constructing it. And that's where the long-term burden ultimately on the state's general fund budget comes into play. But it's a matter of choices. It's a matter of policy choices and about how we want to address those policy choices vis-a-vis the rest of the state budget. And, you know, I think it's a worthy conversation for this committee to have, and we're happy to provide, you know, whatever factual information and data the committee is interested in understanding sort of that hydraulic.
Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, next up, Craig Prinz and Michael Wilson. And while they're setting up, I wanted to just introduce them a little bit by credentials. Craig Prinz was appointed Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission by Governor Kulongoski in 2004. He received his law degree from the University of Notre Dame Law School. He served as the Deputy District Attorney in Multnomah County from 1997 to 2002. And he served as counsel for the Oregon Legislature's Judiciary Committee during the 2001 and 2003 sessions. Michael Wilson is an economist for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, who serves as Oregon Statistical Analysis Director, Center Director. He received his bachelor's and master's degrees in economics from the University of California at San Diego. He worked as a policy research analyst at UCSD in labor economics. He was also an adjunct faculty member at Point Loma Nazarene University, and he most recently worked as an economist for the Oregon Employment Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name's Craig Prinz.
And I'm Mike Olson.
We've put together a presentation, and you also have our report to the legislature from the Criminal Justice Commission. This is basically a four-part presentation. It looks at, why don't you go to the next slide. Really, it's based upon the work Steve Ose has done in Washington, and it's a four-part presentation. It looks at incarceration rates,
yep,
the costs of incarceration, and then it looks at crime rates and trends in crime rates. And then the fourth part of it is what we call prison economics, where you look at the relationships between incarceration and crime so that you policymakers have an idea, as the chair said, for a long-term plan of where we're going. And so with that, I'll launch into this. And if you have any questions, you've got our this is in narrative form, basically, in our report. And I also wanted to thank our vice chair of our Criminal Justice Commission, Mike Burton. I wanted to thank him for coming down from Portland for this. To look at Oregon's use of incarceration, we use a rate. And the reason we do that is so we can compare the number of people who are incarcerated per 1,000. You can compare it over time and with different populations. And the first thing to look at is we are below the national average in the use of incarceration. And I say that because basically from the year 1980 to the year 2005, we tripled the number of people who are incarcerated per 1,000, while the rest of the states quadrupled or are basically almost quadrupled that slide. So this graph shows that graphically. And I want to point out, as I think Director Williams said, our incarceration rate is driven mostly by our policy choices we make. And I think your LFO staff, Doug Wilson's, pointed this out in another presentation. For example, when Senate Bill 1145 was passed, you saw that incarceration rate go down because some of the people who would have been at DOC were in local jails. And so this graph, you can see that we are below the incarceration rate of the rest of the states as an average. That being said, if you look at that vertical line and you look at the year about 2000, you'll see that the national growth in incarceration rate basically leveled off around 2000, and Oregon's incarceration rate has continued to grow. So basically, we are moving toward the national average. And because Mr. Ose is going to present later, I wanted to show where Washington's use of incarceration is. Steve, this is looking at it per the whole population of 1,000, not just the adult population. And Steve will use different rates to show that as well. And so I just wanted to give you that perspective because we see a lot of similarities between Oregon and Washington and our policies. This table is a little busy, but I'll try to highlight what we're looking at. If you take that incarceration rate, meaning the number per thousand is growing, our policy of a use of incarceration, we're incarcerating more people per thousand, and of course Oregon's population has grown as well. This shows that same thing, that when you have an increasing incarceration rate and you have an increasing population, it causes the forecast to increase more dramatically than just the incarceration rate. So you can see from 95 to about 2006, we almost doubled our actual prison beds while the incarceration rate increase was about 49%. So that just includes the population rate as well. To give a perspective of our use of incarceration, if we were to try to meet the national average and use this, the policy of incarceration as a public safety policy in the same way as the rest of the states, we would have to increase the number of inmates by about 5,000. And so really the states are on a broad perspective. If you looked at Vermont, they're much lower than us, and then there's states like Texas, Delaware, Louisiana that per their population they use incarceration a lot more. To give you a monetary perspective, Director Williams, because he has a budget that's going to be addressed with you, is very careful to answer Representative Nathan's question of how do you add up the administrative costs, the debt service, and things like that. We had a rough estimate of $280 to $330 million per biennium to get to that if we were going to try to hit that national average. And that is a discussion. I understand the director wanting to make sure that we can talk in broad strokes, and he probably doesn't want to and wants to talk with Mr. Wilson on that. Slide. I couldn't tell if this was in the packet that Director Williams gave you. This is the way that Sue Porter at the Office of Economic Analysis tries to look at different policy changes and how they've impacted the prison bed forecast. So I think Director Williams hit on this, that this captures the amount of the forecast that is related to Measure 11, the repeat property offender, and some of those other major policy changes. And then, of course, this is the forecast, and you can see, you'll see there's a pink portion. That's the future and where we're going. And, yes, the growth has slowed, but slide to give a perspective of what that will cost to meet that growth, that's about 2,600 more beds from July 07 to 2015. And the estimates, the rough estimates of what that would cost on a biennial basis would be about $145 to $170 million per biennium. Slide. The way that we did that, this is, again, kind of responsive to Representative Nathanson's question of Director Williams, is we captured it by looking at the operating costs and the debt service. That would be the purple, or I don't know what, the right-hand bar. And then if you try to factor in the increase of administrative costs as you gradually grow that, that's where you get that that estimate by the time we hit 2015. The director also mentioned Chair Shields talked about this, the trajectory slowing, and is it still an unsustainable trajectory? What I look at is a system that's maturing, basically. That if you look at the years 1995 to 2001, you'll see on Measure 11, which is one of the larger drivers of our forecast, you'll see there were intakes but really no releases, because most of those people were coming in. Measure 11 passed in 94, so no one was being released until about 2002. When the releases started balancing out the number of intakes, you saw a net change that began to diminish. And I really see that as where we are right now, is where have that system is maturing, and that's what's slowing the growth. This slide we put in to give you a perspective of the growth of the DOC incarceration rate compared to local jails, the Oregon Youth Authority closed custody beds, and the juvenile county detention. The top bar, or the top graph, is the DOC incarceration rate, and here we're looking at the number incarcerated for the adult population of 18 to 49. And what this graph represents is DOC builds capacity to keep up with those policy choices. If you look at the jails, they're static because sheriffs have a release authority that when they hit capacity, they begin releasing offenders. And so that matrixing system that you've heard about in your local counties, either because there's not enough staff or there's not enough beds, that's why the jail incarceration rate is flat. And then you can see the Oregon Youth Authority, the third one down, actually that was reduced, and that was directly from the cuts in their budget that occurred in 2003, where they had to basically mothball a couple of their closed custody facilities. And then you can see the use of county detention, I think, is in that same situation. They're all at capacity for what we've got right now.
All right, so as the incarceration rate and the number incarcerated has increased, we wanted to look and see, well, what has happened to taxpayer costs. And so we went and took a look at taxpayer costs, and this is just strictly state general fund criminal justice costs. And we looked at this on a per household basis. So we adjusted for the number of households in Oregon, and we adjusted for inflation to get an idea of what the typical household has to pay per biennium in terms of criminal justice costs. And I guess before I go on any further, let me just define what I have here for criminal justice costs. This is the Department of Corrections, the Youth Authority, the State Police, and then courts. And under the courts, I've got the Judicial Department, their criminal portion, the Public Defense's criminal portion, and then the entire budget for the District Attorneys and the Department of Justice. And so here I've broken down criminal justice spending. This is a little bit different than Mr. Williams had, where this includes the Judicial Department and the Public Defense, but it only includes their criminal portion. So you can see that in this graph, as I think you're all aware of, Department of Corrections is about three-fifths of this. It's the biggest player by far. And then when you add the Oregon Youth Authority, the two together make about three-quarters of the criminal justice budget as it's defined here. So within the Department of Corrections budget, most of this is operations, but there is a substantial part that goes to community corrections, and you see debt service there, a little more than 10% of their general fund budget for 2005-2007. So here I've taken that same information I presented in the first slide on this section and looked at, again, this is the per household inflation-adjusted spending on our state general fund criminal justice spending. So if you look in 85-87, it's about $630 that the average household spent that per biennium on their tax dollars. And if you look as time goes on, the 2005-2007 biennium, it's gone up substantially. It's about a little over $1,100. And so this represents about a 79% increase in the amount that each household is spending. So we wanted to break that down a little bit further to see what was causing that increase. If you look at some of the other portions, you look at the Youth Authority and what I have defined here is the courts, their budgets in terms of inflation-adjusted per household dollars went up between 30% and 40%. I mean, they went up, but it wasn't a substantial amount. If you look at Oregon State Police, theirs actually fell by 20%. And looking at the Department of Corrections is where most of this increase was taking place. Their per household spending went up 180% over this time period. In fact, if you took them out of this picture and you just looked at the other ones, OIA, courts, the state police, instead of a 79% increase, you'd be looking at more like a 20% increase. So they're really what's driving the increase in the criminal justice spending. So we wanted to look a little bit more closely at their budget. And here I have their program services, which include inmate work, education, alcohol and drug, and mental health. And wanted to look at that and compare it to the debt service over the same time period. If you look around, you know, 97-99 biennium and the 99-01 biennium, they're both pretty close. The program services fall fairly sharply after 99-01, and the debt service continues to rise. And so I want to look at this one other way, to look at this. Because if you remember during this time from the previous slides, the number of inmates were increasing. And so we're looking at, this is on a cost per day, per inmate basis. So the debt service is pretty flat, right around $12 over this time period. With the program services, and let me say one thing about the program services. These are the services that are known to reduce recidivism. And this is what Mr. Ost is going to talk about a little bit more in his presentation. But we see that the programs that reduce recidivism are the ones that have, especially on a per-inmate basis, have fallen. And this is about a 60% decrease over this time period on a per-inmate basis.
So I don't think there's been any surprises to this point. We've incarcerated more people, and that costs the taxpayers money. So that's kind of... that's no shock, and the next part of the presentation is what's happened with crime rates, and that's kind of where the good news is. And you wouldn't know this, I don't think, if you watch the news every night, but both violent and property crime have dropped across the country and in Oregon if you looked at it from 1980 to 2005. So this graph is a graph of property crime rates, and that's based upon the FBI's uniform crime reporting. When you hear about property crime rates, they're talking about burglary, larceny, and motor vehicle theft. And what happens is the FBI asks the Oregon State Police to give us the numbers on that so we can look at a rate. So this is reported crime to the police per 1,000. And you can see that for Oregon and the U.S. average, it's decreased since 1980. And you can see that Washington's crime rate is very similar to ours. The good news is Oregon's crime rate has dropped in the area of property crime since 1980. The not so good news is we are one of the higher property crime rate states. Washington and Oregon and Arizona are all those West Coast states, and many people believe this is related to the methamphetamine use that is on the West Coast. Representative Nathanson, I remember from a prior meeting, asked about the victimization reports, and I saw you when I said UCR, you looked at me. We also use the victimization reports. It's harder to do a time series with victimization reports, but I want to make it clear that when Mike talks about total victimization, we take those reports, and we know that that's not all crime, and so there's been several studies of how you take a UCR crime report and the victimization reports and actually try to get an estimate of how much total crime is going. And so we could try to, I just wanted to say that there. Violent crime rates. If we go back to the slide on property crime rates, you could see we were talking a number of around 30 or 40 per 1,000. For violent crime is much less prevalent, but obviously it's much more serious. Here, it's the reported homicide, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. The good news on that is the U.S. and Oregon have both seen a substantial decrease in violent crime over this 25-year period. Washington, again, is very similar to Oregon in violent crime rate. So if you look at the next slide, you can see that Oregon is ranked 34th, District of Columbia having the most prevalent violent crime. We're 34th, and Washington is 29th. So this is a graph where you want to be 50th, obviously. We wanted to also include murder rates to give you an idea of the crime that's the most serious and the most reported. You can see that tracks with those same trends where you had this goes back the farthest too. You can track murder over time longer. And you can see that Oregon has always been below the national average in murder rate. And many people attribute that just to the fact that we have most of the population is a rural population. We don't have the population density that they have on the East Coast. So that's the good news on crime rates.
All right, so we saw that the number incarcerated and the incarceration rate has increased, taxpayer costs have increased, and the crime rate has gone down. So we wanted to look and see what can be said about this relationship. Is there a direct policy there that you can actually lower the crime rates by incarcerating more people? And if so, you know, what? How big of an effect is that? How many crimes can be avoided by incarcerating an additional person? And then the last step of that is to figure out what the costs and benefits are of doing that. What are the benefits of avoiding crime? And so here we've just plotted the crime rates. This is the total crime index rates and the incarceration rate. You can see that in 1980 we had a relatively high crime rate and a relatively low incarceration rate. And by 2005, the incarceration rate was relatively high and the crime rate was relatively low. So we see from this that there's certainly a correlation here. As more people were incarcerated in Oregon, the crime rate went down. So we wanted to see if there's more than a correlation, if there's more of a causal relationship there, if it's just a correlation. So we used a model that is used, kind of a nationally used model by Washington State Institute of Public Policy used it. It's been used in other states as well to try to test this relationship to see, you know, is there a causal relationship between the crime rates and incarceration rates. And so we want to control for other things that are thought to influence crime, such as the demographics, a better economy, higher density population, number of police officers, all these other factors that are thought to influence crime are included in the model so that we can try to isolate the impact of just incarceration on crime rates. And so here I've included a slide, kind of a funny slide, I think, that you see that the violent crime rate has fallen as the price of gasoline's gone up. And I don't think there's any causal relationship here. I don't think anyone would think there's a causal relationship here. But there certainly is a correlation. You can see that, as gas prices have gone up, crime rates have gone down. And so this is the reason that we need to include those other variables in the model to do a more complete analysis of than just looking at two variables and trying to make a conclusion from that. So what we estimate here is what's called an elasticity, and one of the things you learn in an economics class, but it's basically just a measurement of responsiveness. We want to know how do crime rates respond to incarceration rates. So if you incarcerate more people, what happens to crime rates? And national studies have shown that if you increase the incarceration rate by 10%, crime rates go down between 2 and 4%. And so we estimated the same thing for Oregon, and found that the violent crime rate is predicted to fall by 3.4%, and the property crime rate is predicted to fall by 2.6% as a result of increasing the incarceration rate by 10%. So once this elasticity has been estimated, then we can go and we can try to figure out how many crimes are avoided by incarcerating an additional offender. And so that's what we've done here, and this does include we try to figure out how many total crimes, not just reported crimes here. So in 1994, we estimated that there was just under 30 crimes were avoided by incarcerating one additional offender. By 2005, that number had fallen quite a bit. We're down to around 11 crimes were avoided per additional offender that we incarcerated. And so this is what economists call the law of diminishing marginal returns. And what we're seeing happening here is that as you incarcerate the most prolific offenders, you get them off the streets, and so the next offender that you incarcerate isn't as prolific as the first one, so that the number of crimes avoided goes down. So I see that this slide's got a lot of information here, so it might be easier to read later than to go through all of it. But basically, once we have the number of crimes avoided by incarcerating an additional offender, we can try to back out of that what the benefit is to society. So if we avoid a crime, there's going to be benefits in terms of taxpayer costs that are avoided. You're going to avoid arrests. You're going to avoid convictions, incarceration, probation, all the things that are in the criminal justice system. And you're also going to avoid victimization costs. And these are going to include tangible costs, such as wages that are lost, such as medical bills. And this also includes intangible losses, such as pain and suffering and quality of life. And there's a national study that is well respected that estimates these using court cases, uses wage differentials between risky jobs, and they try to estimate some of these intangible losses that occur from crime. And then we throw in the cost of incarceration, and then we can back out a benefit to cost ratio. And so here it is a table of that, and there's a lot of numbers here, but the way this reads, if you look at 1994 under Oregon, you get the $3.31. So what this is saying is that for every $1 invested in incarceration, Oregon in 1994 got a return of $3.31. And this was in terms of taxpayer costs and our taxpayer benefits and victimization benefits. I should note here that there's some costs that that occur that are, I guess, benefits of avoiding crime that occur that we weren't able to capture, such as third-party benefits. If there's fewer crimes, you feel safer walking out at night. Another thing we didn't capture here is a sense of justice of someone being put away for a crime they committed. Those are some of the benefits that we aren't able to capture in this model. So again, this is only measuring taxpayer benefits and victimization benefits. But as you see in 2005, as you move down, $1 invested in incarceration returned just over a dollar. So it's about a break even in terms of, again, taxpayer costs and victimization costs. I've also included the Washington numbers here. We weren't able to break it out into different offender types, but they were. And you can see that in Washington, you get the biggest bang for your buck for incarcerating the violent offenders. If you look in 2005, for every dollar invested, you got $4.35 back for violent offenders. The property offenders were right about a break even. And for the drug offenders, for every dollar you invested, you're only getting 35 cents back. And so we've shown, we tried to show that the incarceration rate, the crime rates are similar between Oregon and Washington. And so there's reason to believe these numbers might hold for Oregon as well. We weren't able to test it ourselves, but we wanted to include this as well. So the policy implications or the future research to be done here, I think if we could do that for Oregon to evaluate which offenders are the most efficient to incarcerate, and then we're going to see the presentation from Mr. Ose, but to do that same type of study for Oregon, to look at different programs, look at some of the programs that are known to reduce recidivism, and to try to figure out which of those are the most effective and what type of return we can expect on that investment. And so that's all we have. So if we open up for questions.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much for your presentation. We've got time for maybe two questions so that we can get out of here at 5, like I promised. Representative Barker. Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we see the models of the Measure 11 stacking up, and I know people are getting longer, so that's going to build that up, but Measure 11 isn't why people are there. I mean, they're committing crimes. They have to stay a little longer. So is that model not somewhat misleading in that without Measure 11, we would still be seeing an increase in incarceration because those same people would still be doing the robberies and rapes? And
Representative Shields, Representative Barker, I mean, I think I understand your question. I think that when you look at, I think your question is, did Measure 11 increase the incarceration rate? Is that what you're saying?
I know it. And I know it, there's more people in prison because of it, because they're serving longer terms. But some of those same people would be in there maybe for a little shorter time, but they would still be in there for these violent crimes,
yep.
I think.
That's right. I think, and I we should have, Sue Porter has done an estimate of the change difference between that, and I can get that for you. What we tried to capture is basically keeping an offender, one offender for one more year. What would the benefit of that be?
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. First, a very quick comment and then my question. The quick comment on page 8, I want to underscore that the costs that were being described are costs only from state criminal justice system. It does not include what taxpayers are paying for local, whether it's city or county, public safety services. That number would be even a lot bigger.
Yeah, I did a very rough estimate of this, and we didn't have very good data to do anything like that over time, but it was very close to the same that the state was paying and the local counties were paying, so it was pretty similar.
Thank you. My question is something that was mentioned earlier. Counties are at capacity. Did you mean generally or literally at capacity? And specifically, I would want to know, are counties at capacity in housing inmates because that's all they can afford, or literally they're at capacity with regard to physical facilities?
Chair Shield, Representative Nathanson, I think it's a mixture of both. I put that in the graph to show the difference between a jail where you have, in a year, you might have 190,000 bookings across the state into jails. But they're there for a short time, and the sheriff has a release authority. When it's overcrowded, he can release them. There's not a mandate to build to keep with it. So I think that that graph shows that's a policy choice in itself, that the DOC increases with the number of intakes, and the jails don't. They tend to recirculate. So when I said capacity, it really is it's different in each county. Some don't have the physical beds. Some don't have the budget to pay for the staff to staff the jails. They do have to decide to increase their jail capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Prentz, this is probably directed towards you. And it's a follow-up about the county situation having release authority in Oregon. And there was a statement made that our prison population has continued to grow faster than the rest of the United States since 1995. And I'm curious, do those other states that have maybe leveled off, do they have the same lower corrections county release authority? I mean, there's got to be some correlation to these overcrowded jails at the lower level, people going out and repeating and becoming customers of the Department of Corrections later. I'm curious about that.
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, I think your question is there a way to look at the national jails? Is that to look at, see if there's the same type of issue?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, yeah, just basically if we're looking at other states that maybe have leveled off, are their jail situations the same as in Oregon, crowded or full?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, that's a good question. I'll have to get back to you on it. I'm not sure that we could look and see if the federal data, we can try to answer that. But I'm not, don't feel comfortable trying to answer right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know you guys have both put a lot of hard work into this presentation. Thanks. All right. While Steve Aos is bringing his presentation up, I wanted to read a bit off of his biography. Steve Aos is the Associate Director of the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, an applied research group for the Washington State Legislature. And for those of you who aren't familiar with that work, one of the things that's interesting about it is that they only do work for the state legislature. They don't, they're not in a position where they have to go out and search for grants to keep their doors open. They have a budget item, and then the different agencies contract with his institute. He has 30 years of experience in conducting cost-benefit analysis and in presenting the results to policymakers in a wide range of public policy areas as well as in the private sector. He has worked for the Washington State Budget Office, Seattle City Light, the Northwest Power Planning Council, Washington Utilities and Transportation Commission, and has run his own consulting firm where he wrote a newsletter on Washington State economy. Mr. Aos.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a great thrill to be here in Oregon. I left our legislature is in session as well, and it was great to have a sunny day to make the drive down here today. When you drive across our region and when it's sunny, you realize why we all live here in the Northwest. Today I'm going to talk about a report that we produced for our legislature on options that they would have available to them, if there are options, to control their future prison budgets. And so this is a report that we published in the fall. I'll talk to it a little bit. I'll cover some of the same topics that Craig and Mike just covered, maybe a little bit different and using some Washington State data. Here's the institute that I work for. It was created by the legislature back in 1983. We don't exist in statute up there. We're sort of an in-house consulting firm to the legislature. We're governed by our board of directors, 16 members, 8 of whom are from the House and the Senate, equally divided between the two parties. We have the governor appoints 2 members to our board, and then we have members from the higher education institutions as well on our board of directors. All the activity that we do stems from, as you mentioned, the work that the legislature gives us to do, including the study we're talking about today. In 2005, the legislature asked us to do this, and here's the language that we got in a bill. to study options to stabilize future prison populations. We had just funded a brand new prison in the state, and the legislature said, gee, we'd like to not have to do that for a few years. We'd like to be able to put the money into K-12 education and some other things. What kind of options do we have that would be available to us that would help keep crime rates down, but also help reduce our prison budgets? So, and the direction to continue to further to study the net long-run and short-run fiscal savings to state and local governments of implementing a bunch of evidence-based programs. If you did that and you did some portfolio analysis and you projected the impacts, that's what I'll be talking about today, what would the future of Washington look like in terms of its crime rates and in terms of the amount of money that taxpayers have to spend on the system? So the report that we published in October is out. It's being considered by the legislature. There are a bunch of bills actively being heard today and tomorrow and next week on implementing some of the recommendations of the report. Let's do a little bit of background check here. Craig presented some of this information a minute ago. I'm going to go back even farther than 1960, go back all the way to 1930 to get an even a larger historical context on incarceration rates, the same kind of number that Craig just presented here. This is the number of people that we incarcerate out of 1,000 people, and I'm going to narrow it down a little bit to adults, 18 to 49-year-olds, because those are the main population group out of which we incarcerate people. Here's the rate of the United States that we see, and we can see that quintupling of the rate. I'll put Washington's rate up here, as well as our current forecast. So, back in 1930, my father was a young boy in Everett, Washington, north of Seattle, and we had about 2 people out of 1,000 adults were incarcerated in the Walla Walla prison back in 1930 when my dad was 9 years old. 1975, a lot of things had happened by 1975. World War II had happened, the Depression had happened, Elvis Presley had happened, TV had happened, but the incarceration rate was still about the same, 2 people incarcerated out of 1,000 adults. What's happened since that time is about a quintupling of the incarceration rate nationwide for the average state. For Washington, we've grown much more slowly than the United States as a whole. But as you can see there, as a result of legislation passed by our legislature in the last couple of years, the current forecast is for that incarceration rate to continue out for the next few years. What that means for us in Washington is we're about ready to build some more prisons. Here's the existing prison capacity that we have in Washington. It's about an 18,000-bed system right now. We also rent some jail cells from local units of government to house some of the prison violators. And here's that forecast that we just saw in terms of now the number of beds that we'll be needing. And what you can see there is that we're going to have about a 2-prison gap. We build prisons to about house about 2,000 people. A 2-prison gap by 2020, growing to about a 3-prison gap by 2030. So the direction for this study is to see, is there something that makes economic sense that could move that red line down so that it's closer to the current system of supply and demand without having to build those new prisons? Is there anything that we can do? And we'll see in a minute, we think there are some things that we can do that are pretty good deals for taxpayers. Let's also take a look at those crime rates and taxpayer costs, the same kind of thing that were just mentioned here, maybe looked at it in just a little bit different way. We'll go all the way back from 1980 out to the present time right now. And as we noted a minute ago, in Oregon, and this is the same way in Washington, the good news here is that crime rates are down. If you go across the Columbia River into any part of Washington, you're about a 26% less chance of being a victim of a crime today than if you'd crossed that river back in 1980. So that's good news. We're safer in Washington than we used to be by all measures of crime that we can look at. If we look at the bad news, economists always like to dwell on the bad news, and so here's the bad news. The bad news is we're paying a lot more for the taxpayer finance portion of the criminal justice system. And here's what I've done, just like what was done before. I've taken all the local government costs and the state government costs for the whole criminal justice system. Police costs, criminal prosecutor costs in the local courts, local jail costs, local juvenile corrections costs, and all the state costs as well for juvenile and adult corrections. Divide by the number of households, take inflation out of it, and what you see is about a doubling in the real price of that each household has to pay for criminal justice system, from about $589 a household back in 1980 to about about $1,100 a household today. Now, there is a causal relationship there. We're going to talk about that. There, we've been spending more money per household on the criminal justice system, and it hasn't been just throwing the money out the window and letting it fly away. Part of the reason that crime rates are down, is that we're spending a lot more money on the system. We're buying more prisons. We're putting more police per capita on the street in Washington, and we've begun to play for some programs that we think work. And so all those things are the reasons, in part, that the crime rates are down. So we don't want to just think that that was entirely wasted money. But the question, I think, that, and this is what our legislature asked us to look at, what can we do in Washington State that can keep crime rates down, if we just could extend that line out, keep the crime rates down, but let's look at different options that we have, and what we would like to do is see if we can select that future line that would cause taxpayer costs to go down. Can we optimize the portfolio a little bit, to use some financial mumbo jumbo there? So here's what we did. we sort of a three-step research approach. So the first thing that we looked at is what works, what sort of evidence-based scientific evidence is there out there that works to reduce crime, including building prisons, but including looking at a bunch of alternative programs, both in the adult system, in the juvenile system, and the prevention system itself. We read thousands, actually, of studies. We found 571 studies that have been done somewhere in the United States, or a few other in Canada and a couple cases in England, of real-world evaluations that were rigorous in nature, the kinds of things we hope the FDA does when they decide to prove the drugs or not. You know, there's a control group and there's a treatment group, and you see what the difference is afterwards. You don't just hope that this drug works. You actually want to have a scientific test of it. And so what we looked for is what evidence is out there that things work or don't work. And we found 571 evaluations of those that we'll be talking about in just a second. Not each one, of course. And then we wanted to say is, what are the economics of each of those options? You know, everything, nothing's free, everything costs some money, so each of those programs are going to cost money. Where do we get the best bang for the buck? And then after we did that, we then take a look at some alternative portfolios. Again, what combinations of those programs that if we put in place in Washington, could we get an overall rate of return, the best rate of return for Washington's taxpayers? Don't put all your stuff in one basket and spread that around. So we'll be talking about a couple sample portfolios that we looked at in this process. We do can divide those interventions into sort of prisons, police, and programs. Almost everything we can talk about is going to fit into one of those areas. These are public policy options. The things that we do in our private lives have as much to do with how much crime there's going to be as what we do in the public life. How we raise our children is going to have a lot more to do about crime rates than what the kind of public programs we run. But within the options that the legislature, your counterparts in Olympia can do, we're looking at the public policy options that you can pull through your budgetary process here in Salem or in Olympia to affect those kinds of crimes. And we know that all three of these things cost money. There is no free lunch. It's one of those iron laws of economics that Mike talked about a minute ago, that everything costs money. We also know from reading all those evaluations that all three of those things can be effective or ineffective depending on how you use them. We know that prison can reduce crime if you use prison for the right kinds of criminals. We know that some of the programs work, some don't work, and we know that police can work or not work depending on how you deploy those police. So there's evidence, there's no silver bullet. You have to be a pretty smart shopper and an investor here is what we've learned. And that's why we focus on the fourth P, is a portfolio kind of an approach to putting the right package of those investments together, because you don't want to put them all too many in one basket. You're going to be in trouble. Today what we're going to be talking about are prisons and programs. I'm not going to talk about police. The legislature didn't ask us to look at the police. It's primarily a local government matter in our state. It's a good legislature to look at. I think probably be asked to add that to the repertoire. But for this study, we're just going to talk about prisons and programs, not police today. So Prison Economics 101. This is Washington's version of what was just presented to you for Oregon. We're going to now take a look at that crime rate again. We just saw that crime rate a minute ago. This is the total number of non-drug-related crimes per 1,000 population. And across the bottom, we'll put that same incarceration rate that we looked at a minute ago, the number of people that we have incarcerated per 1,000 people. Now, if you believe that prison doesn't work to reduce crime, if you just believe that, then what you would expect to see is a flat line there, that no matter how you as a legislature adjusted that incarceration rate, the crime rate's not going to be related to anything that you do to adjust that. If you're on the other hand, you're in the camp that believes that prison really works, you'd expect to see a pretty straight line there, a much more vertical line, that even when you make a slight adjustment to your incarceration rate, you're going to see crime rate really drop or really rise, depending on how you adjusted that. And as it turns out, what we'll see, like so many things in life, truth seems to be kind of in the middle. Let's look at the numbers for Washington State. Here we were in Washington in 1980. We had an incarceration rate of about 2 people per 1,000, and we had a crime rate of about 70 per 1,000. We began in the early 1980s to increase our incarceration rate out from 2 to about 3, and as we did, the crime rate was going down. And then for a few years after we introduced some sentencing reform legislation, the incarceration rate decreased, and when we did, the crime rate went back up a bit. And every year since then, the crime rate, the incarceration rate has been increased generally, and crime rates have gone down. So when we've done our economic model, probably the same kind that Mike did here, adjusting for changes in demographics and economics and all those kinds of things, what we find is a relationship that looks something like this, which is roughly a 10% change in incarceration rates leads to a 2 to 4% reduction in crime rates. It varies depending on the type of crime and so on, but as a general rule of thumb, that's not a bad rule of thumb. It seems like it's similar to what Mike has found here in Oregon, and it's very close to what we found in Washington State, too. So there's a sort of a relationship there that you can then take that relationship and try to estimate the economics of do we have too much prison or not enough prison, given where we've expanded the system. So that brings up Prison Economics 102, and this is going to be the hardest thing, again, that we talk about today, diminishing returns. Mike hit on it there a second ago. This is one of those things that in an economics course in school, you get, you know, you spend quite a few sessions on this topic here. But basically, it means that the party's all going to be over at some time. This is why economists get the name of being kind of a negative sort. You know, good things can't go on forever. You go to a party, and pretty soon you leave the party because you're not having any more fun. You got better options. Starbucks has to face this. Any business has to face this, diminishing returns. If it wasn't diminishing returns, we'd have one firm. Microsoft would do everything in the world, not just software. They would do everything in the world. But they face diminishing returns when they start to expand too much. I looked up there in Salem, within a 10-mile radius of where we're sitting here today, there are 15 Starbucks stores. And the question is, if you were running Starbucks, is why do you have 15 stores here? Why don't you have 5? Or why don't you have 150? Why have you stopped at 15? And the answer is that if Starbucks only had 5 stores, they could make more money for their stockholders by building the 6th store and the 7th store. But as they do that, they're beginning to make less and less money with each successive store. And if they expanded out to 150, they wouldn't be probably even covering the operating costs of opening that next store up. So right now, they figure that 15 stores is the best deal that they can do for their stockholders, and so they expand the system out to 15 stores. Now, we can learn that same lesson, when we think about our prison system. We've already seen that we've increased those incarceration rates. The question is, how high should we increase them? We could increase them to 100% and have everybody in prison, in which case the crime rate would go to zero. Or we could, on the other end of it, have the crime rate, the incarceration go to zero and let everybody out. But the question is, where do we want to be on that? What we found when we looked at the Washington system, here's our incarceration rate again. Here's the number of crimes avoided. As we've increased that incarceration rate, the number of crimes that we've been able to avoid has gone down. Just like Starbucks, we're getting diminishing returns the more we expand our system. So that back in 1980, on average, we were avoiding 50 or 60 crimes each time we built a new prison cell and expanded our incarceration rate. Today, it's down to about 10 crimes avoided, mostly property crimes, sometimes just larceny. So that's going to narrow down the economics, and as Mike showed our numbers a minute ago, we've probably got, in Washington State, unlike Oregon, we have too many drug offenders in prison today. We're not covering our costs on the cost of that return of that drug offender. We've got about the right number of property offenders, and we have too many. We don't have enough violent offenders in prison today. We could stand to build some more cells for those offenders. Now, the question is, and I know you can't read this, but it's in our report. I just want to show you. This is our Consumer Reports list of everything that we've been able to determine, all those 570 valuations of things that work. And some things on that list that don't work. Not everything is that evidence bases work. Sometimes evidence tells you things don't work and you don't want to do those things. So we've got juvenile programs, adult programs. We're going to highlight a couple of them in just a second from now. And it's from this list that we're going to put together those portfolios and suggest that if Washington embarks on a little bit different of a portfolio, we can actually do some good turns for taxpayers in the state of Washington. Before we look at a couple programs, here's one general lesson that we learned after we looked at all those programs. And roughly, what are the odds of success if we're talking about treating or rehabilitating offenders, whether they be juvenile offenders or adult offenders? Let's take an example here. Suppose you've got 100 people who've been convicted for a felony crime and you're going to treat them with some kind of program. It may be a drug program, it may be a cognitive behavioral program, it may be an employment program. What we know is that without treatment, we estimate, without doing any kind of evidence-based program, we've looked at our numbers in Washington State and we know that about 54% of those offenders will reoffend with a new felony conviction after about a 13-year period. If we do one of those evidence-based programs, and we're going to look at them, a couple of them in just a second or so, we think that that number can be reduced, on average, to about 49%. Now, of course, we were hoping when we looked at these evidence-based things that we would find some magic bullet that would reduce that recidivism rate down to 20% or 0% or 5%. But what the sober look that I think you have to take is that these programs, generally, the best ones can reduce recidivism rates somewhere in the neighborhood of 5%, and some of the better ones in the juvenile system up to 20%. And it's the question is that small of a change worth it economically? And that's what we're asking here. And the good news is it turns out it is. Even that small of a change can actually have a, because it's expensive to deal with crime in the aftermath for the taxpayers and for victims, some of the programs look awfully attractive. So I'm going to look at a couple of them here. We're going to look at some adult offender programs that made our list, juvenile offender programs, and prevention programs. And we've got the juvenile offender programs up there because one of the things we learned by doing a little analysis of who's in our prisons right now, we learned that 73% of the people that are in Washington prisons today had already been in our juvenile justice system. So that's just an opening line there that if we can find some things that work in the juvenile justice system, you're probably going to get a better return on your dollar because you're going to be deferring those systems, those crimes that are going to cost a lot more money once the adult system comes into play. So we found a number of those. Let's take a look at some adult offender programs. Cognitive behavioral treatment. This is a general kind of approach we have in our prisons. I don't know which of these are in your Oregon system right now. We found that 25 studies, let's just take a look what's up there. We found 25 well-done comparison group studies that have been done throughout the United States. One of them was done in Washington State. And on average, if you're a betting person, on average, we think they reduce recidivism rates about 6.3%. You always hope for a Lake Wobegon effect to have that above average program, but if you're a betting person, which I think you are if you're putting the taxpayers' dollars on the line, I would plan on about a 6.3% unless you can figure out how to get a better than average return. That return, we think, generates about $10,000 per person that you put in the program on average. So it's a very good rate of return. I could show you the return on investment kinds of numbers there, but these would be investment numbers that would make people on Wall Street very, very happy. Something on the order of about, this one would be on the order of about 30 or 40% return, internal rate of return on investment. So a terrific investment from that standpoint. Various kinds of in-prison education programs, we think. We found 17 evaluations of those programs. They reduce recidivism rates about 7% on average. Again, you always hope for the above average. We always hope when we build a stock portfolio that we're going to have Microsoft in there and would get that long-term. But the best prudent thing to do is to suggest that you can get the S&P 500 as your thing, not that one stock that happens to do real well. Drug treatment in prison is also one that looks awfully good to us. These can be both therapeutic communities that we have in Washington, I believe you have in Oregon, and outpatient programs as well. There's about 6.6% again reduction in recidivism rates. Again, positive numbers on the benefit-to-cost ratios. Drug courts, we've got them in our state, you've got them in Oregon. We found 57 evaluations. Some of those evaluations were of the Oregon courts. Some of them were of Washington courts and others around the country. About 8% return reduction in recidivism rate. The economics are lower there. You don't get as big a rate of return because the kind of people that we put in drug courts, by definition, are lower risk offenders. And when you got lower risk offenders, it means they're probably not going to be as likely to recidivate, so that the net gain that we get in terms of crime reduction is still very positive, a good investment, but you don't get quite the return that you do on some programs for more serious offenders. Here's the one that's a loser. Intensive ISP, which stands for Intensive Supervision, Probation, or Parole, where what you do is you count contacts. You how many times does that offender come before you? You have them come in three times a week as opposed to twice a week, and you lower the caseload size of the worker. We found 23 evaluations of that have been done. No significant effect on recidivism rate. So if you're spending money on those kinds of programs to reduce the caseload of the average probation and parole worker, but not focusing on the treatment, you're not lowering the in crime rate anything, and any money that you're doing that could probably be better spent on some of the treatment programs. In fact, we found that when you couple intensive supervision, probation, or parole with one of those kinds of treatment programs, 11 studies have done that, you get an even bigger percentage return on your investment, and a very attractive investment. So probably some combination of supervision, maybe more intensive supervision, and treatment is what would be the indicated strategy here. On the juvenile side, I'll just throw them all up there at once. We found some very attractive investments. Many of these we've already invested in the state of Washington in our system. Some of them we've also evaluated and found these kinds of rates of returns there. So you notice those rates of returns are much bigger for that same point that we talked about just a minute ago. If you invest in those kids and turn those kids around, they're right at their crime high crime peak years in the age 17, 18, and into the early adulthood. If you can stop those crime curves from taking place, you save a lot more money. So when we put these portfolios together, we're going to see that juvenile offender programs and prevention programs are at least need to be half of the portfolio. Prevention programs for people that are very young, preschool programs for low income, looks like a very good investment in terms of crime reduction as well as getting kids ready for school testing. And some other kinds of programs that I won't go into now, a nurse-family partnership program, which I believe is in Oregon, it is in Washington, a home visiting program for unborn and then children and then into their first 2 years of life also looks very attractive to us in terms of crime reduction later on in that kid's life. So I mentioned we're going to look at portfolios. So there's a whole range of programs. We've got our consumer reports list, and now we're going to, like an investment, we're going to say, well, let's put together some of those stocks and bonds into a portfolio and then see what kind of rate of return we can get. That's what we're going to do here for the crime system. We're going to put together some of those investments and then see what effect it can have on future prison construction in Washington and taxpayer costs and crime rates. I won't go into these now, but these are the programs that are in our example portfolio. We got a bunch of adult offender programs, some juvenile offender programs. Most of these we're already doing at a certain level in Washington State, and the portfolios are going to ramp those programs up, that penetration rate up, and some representative prevention programs. So those are the things that we're going to analyze here, and now we want to take a look at what effect could that have on the state of Washington. So there's that chart once again. There's our prison supply capacity. That's the same chart we looked at a minute ago. And there's the 2 and 3 prison gap that we have in our system. And the question is, how can we make that red line move if we take some investment portfolio options that are a little bit different than what we're doing right now in the state of Washington? And we'll look at some numbers down below in that box there. So if we just continue to do what we're doing now, which is a broad-based program of prison construction. We're going to be building a couple new prisons, you can see there, and the kinds of prevention programs and rehabilitation programs that are already in our current level budgets. So if we just keep doing what we're doing now, we're going to build two prisons. And what we would expect if we run the programs we're running right now is we're going to see that need for future prison construction is going to drop a bit. It returns. Let's take a look at those numbers. We think that is a very good, doing what we're doing right now in Washington State is going to return taxpayers a very good return on their investment. $1.1 billion of return, and the crime rate's going to drop down to 48. And the reason that there's a positive rate of return, 24% return on investment, Because if we stop doing all the drug prevention programs and the juvenile rehabilitation programs, the prevention programs that we're doing now, that red line would actually go up off the chart. That we would be building not two new prisons, but we'd be building about four new prisons by the time 2020 rolls around. So the programs that we already have in place in Washington, if we're just achieving the average effect that we expect they're achieving, is already saving Washington's taxpayers about $1.1 billion. So we don't recommend zero budgeting, you know, wiping out all the programs. We want to at least continue the current level strategy that we have in the state of Washington right now. But where things get interesting is to take a look at a couple of alternative portfolios. Let's take a look at what we're going to call here a moderate expansion portfolio. And by moderate, what we mean is that we're going to take and expand to 20% of the potential market out there for each of those programs. So let's just see what that means. Right now, we're serving all the offenders that come into prison that have a drug problem. Our Department of Corrections tells us that we're treating about 50% of those offenders with some kind of drug treatment program. And so what we'd be doing of the remaining 50% that have a drug treatment problem, we're going to serve 20% of that remaining 50%. So an additional 10% of the offenders we would be budgeting dollars for to treat with prison. Similarly, on the juvenile offender programs, drug court programs, and so on, we're just going to take whatever we're not doing now and take 20% of that market. Not anymore. That's what we're going to call the moderate portfolio. And what you can see there is that we think we can save about a prison's worth of construction if we take those steps. It's going to cost about $63 million a year to continue doing what we're doing now budget-wise and expand the portfolio. So we have to be able to find those funds in the operating budget. The long-run benefits are going to go up to about $1.7 billion in taxpayer savings as a result of doing that, and the crime rate's going to stay about the same. If we take an aggressive approach, and by aggressive here, instead of expanding the market to 20% of the remaining potential, we're going to go up to 40% of the remaining potential. And this is a Herculean task for our agencies. This would be a Herculean task. It's within their realm of possibility they could do it, but it's a significant expansion in what they have to do and the number of drug treatment slots they have, the number of juvenile correction slots, and the number of drug courts that would be needed to expand this kind of effort. But if you do that, our numbers would indicate that we can avoid building any new prisons in the foreseeable future, assuming our legislature doesn't change the sentencing laws. But given the current sentencing laws that are already on the books, we think that they can reduce that. And it's interesting to look at the results here. The crime rates are going to be about the same, about flat crime rates. In other words, you can go on any one of those portfolios. If you build prisons, you're going to reduce the crime rate. If you go more heavily on the program side and not on the prison side as the moderate aggressive, you're also going to reduce the crime rate down to about the same level. What the real difference is on the cost side. That these programs in the portfolio, the reason why they're economically attractive and merge to the top of the list is that if we do them, we're going to save taxpayers up to $2.25 billion of savings. So what we think the portfolios do is they all lower the crime rate. We can build prisons and lower the crime rate, or we can actually, in the aggressive case, avoid building any new prisons for a while, but substitute in a more aggressive use of programs, keep the crime rate at about the same level as if we had built the prisons, but save taxpayers an additional, depending if you want how you want to treat the current level, either additional $2.4 billion or additional $1 billion. So the bottom line for us is that as we look at the Washington situation, is there's tremendous potential here to save taxpayers money and keep the crime rates lower. And that really then is our main finding. If Washington decides to modify and expand its current portfolio of evidence-based options, we're already doing a bunch of stuff, so that's good. If we decide to expand it to moderate or aggressive kinds of portfolios, and it has to be not just in the adult system. When we think about prisons, we're all in a little bit of silo thinking here. We think about the adult system. But we have to think about the adult system, the juvenile system, and the prevention system. If you think about that whole package, which is what we've almost have to have in order to pull this off, if you do that, then you can avoid these significant levels of future prison construction, save taxpayers a couple billion dollars, and keep crime rates about the same level where they would have been if you hadn't adopted those approaches. So it's really a pretty good news finding, despite the fact I'm an economist who usually gives bad news about we're not saving enough money and all that kind of stuff. this is pretty good news story here, is that there are some investments out there that research evidence, rigorous research evidence, would indicate that there are some pretty good investments. You have to be a smart consumer because there are bad investments. If you don't do the right thing, you can make mistakes, but there's some good findings. So let me just close with a couple of thoughts here. The notion of a portfolio is what should be important part of the public policies in your state and in our state, I think, and we're moving in that direction in Washington. We're thinking about crime in terms of the adult system, the juvenile system, and the prevention system. All those things are needed. If you just focus on the adult system, we're not going to be able to get those kinds of results that we looked at a minute ago. Assessment is a very important topic. Most of these programs, if you put the wrong kinds of offenders, if you put a person that doesn't have a drug problem into one of these drug offender programs, it's not going to do any good. So you got to make sure that you've got an assessment system in place in both your adult system and in your juvenile system so that you're putting the right person that's going to benefit from that program. And it's not impossible to do that. We're putting those systems in place in Washington right now. But it's very important to assess the market that way. Many of these programs require state and local efforts combined. Drug courts are an example of that. Some of our juvenile court programs, which is a local system, require a coordination between state and local governments to pull them off. The state saves money when you avoid prison, and so the state needs to set up a funding mechanism to fund those local government efforts. Those are tricky things to do. There's a natural tension between state and local governments. I think from a democratic purpose, it's a good tension. It helps promote better government. But we got to exploit that system so that we can set up those efforts. We're trying to pilot some of those efforts in Washington right now, because it's really state and local approaches to pull this portfolio stuff off. Accountability is an important word, I'm sure, in Salem. I know it is in Olympia. And what this means in terms of what we got here, most of these programs fail if they're not implemented by the book. We've tried some of these programs in Washington State where some of the therapists went off and did it by the book, and some of the therapists went off and did their own thing. We evaluated it subsequently. We thought that this was the investment. Everyone was going to do it by the book. No one did it. When we evaluated it, we found out the therapists that were doing these programs by the book were getting the kinds of returns that we expected. The ones that went off and did their own thing were not doing it. They didn't reduce recidivism rates at all. So just like Starbucks, we got to have quality control, and it'll be up to Secretary Williams and the other people that you hire to run these agencies, the governor hires to run these agencies, to make sure that you're implementing whatever kind of programs you put in place the way they were intended to be implemented. Otherwise, they can go wrong, just like Starbucks could go wrong if it didn't implement its program with quality control and didn't stress it. And finally, experiment. I use this as a verb, not a noun here. While we have a good long list of things for which evidence indicates that they work, it's still a relatively short list. There are probably some ideas that need to be tried out for which there's no evidence, but that make intuitive sense to you. Mental health courts. There's not enough evaluations yet to know definitively whether mental health courts work or not. At least in our opinion, there isn't enough evaluations. It's probably a good idea. They may not work in the end, but it's probably a good idea. So it may be the kind of thing where you want to put part of your portfolio into some experimental things, but make sure you evaluate them so that you know what you got later on. Any business does this. They call this research and development in the business world. You got to be thinking about your future products, not just the ones where your main line is involved in. So what we encourage our legislature to do is to devote at least a portion of the portfolio to some new ideas, and then to be sure and evaluate them. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my comments. I'd be delighted to take any questions that you have.
Mr. Arias, thank you very much. I think one thing that I gained out of this and my evidence, my experience with the literature, is that we often say treatment works, but I think some treatment works, some treatment doesn't, and some treatment works better than others. And
it's like the stock market. Some stocks make it and some don't. You have to be a good investor. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll open up for questions. Senator Wesley.
I have a very penetrating question. Actually, first a comment. Thank you very much for your exemplary presentation. I leaned over to our committee staff and said this is some of the best stuff I've seen on this subject ever. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. But now to the penetrating question.
But here's the but part. I knew it was.
I assume the sunshine was equally prevalent in both Washington and Oregon on your way down here. My only question is, which state was more beautiful?
Well, They're both marvelous. I could live either one.
You're doing fine.
I love them. You know, Mount St. Helens, before it blew, might have been tipped it toward Washington, but now after the eruption, it could go either way.
I don't know if we can handle many hardball questions.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
A tough one.
Senator Burdick.
My apologies for my colleague. Just kidding. On your cost-benefit analysis a few slides back where you show the amount of money saved, does that formula include the productivity of the people who aren't in prison, like the taxes they pay? And I think you did say it does include the value of the crimes not being committed. Is that correct? What does that include?
Yeah, the one slide, if I could just see if this goes backward with some ease. That slide, those are just taxpayer savings there.
From not having them in prison?
Yeah.
So it doesn't even count tax revenue that they contribute by working or anything like that?
If I could do that, I would put that in there as a benefit, but I don't know empirically with rigor that link between not committing crime and working more and paying taxes. There's an increasing amount of evidence that would allow us to estimate that in the future, but it's not sufficient today to allow us to estimate it. I will add, though, that on the previous slide, so those are just taxpayer savings there.
Mm-hmm.
When we run our models, I'm going to go backwards here just a second. Those benefit cost ratios include not just taxpayer savings, but also the savings to crime victims when they aren't victimized by crime. So when we look at the individual items that might go into the portfolio, whether any program itself makes it, we don't just narrow our focus down to the taxpayer interests. We try, because we do these programs because we're interested in victims and not having victims be victims. And so that includes our estimate of taxpayer savings and the benefits and victim benefits. But because our legislature had asked us just to, for the purpose of these portfolios back here, just to look at the taxpayer savings, that those lines just include, just from a narrow budget writing committee taxpayer perspective.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When you were talking about increasing the level of treatment to the moderate and aggressive, you're talking about, you have to assume that there is some kind of selectivity in the 20% that get selected to start the treatment. Hopefully they would pick the ones who are most likely to benefit from it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, you have to have those risk assessment instruments in there. Cause you
right.
Wanna,
so yeah. When you go to 80%, when you go to your most aggressive increase in these programs, theoretically, you're getting to a population that is more difficult. Is there a diminishing return on those?
Yeah, we model that, and we expect that return. We're a little bit uncertain about how much return is going to be, but we do believe in diminishing returns everywhere. And as we talked about a minute ago, whether it's Starbucks or prison systems, we're going to get less return as we begin to expand those programs. So first of all, we don't want to expand beyond 40% because we're just uncertain once you go beyond that whether the people out on the end of the curve are going to benefit at all from that. It's getting too far away from what was actually the evidence indicates. So we don't want to do that. And the discussion in Olympia is not about going out 80%, get 80% of the market. It's down there in the 20, expand by 20% kind of an approach. So I feel like we're pretty close to what we could expect to get. But if we tried to move that out there, those penetration rates, if you will, out farther, we would expect diminishing returns, and we model those in this model here.
Just one final follow-up.
We've got three other questions, then we have to get to the... Thank you, Senator Burdick. So we've got about three more minutes, and we've got Representative Barker, Cameron, and McPherson.
Just very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. The numbers are very impressive, and like you say, one of the things that I'm always concerned about is the victims, and you can't quantify that. For example, I have a brother-in-law who was recently robbed, and he said that one of the things that annoyed him the most was after that, when a young black man would come in his business, his hackles would go up for a while. And so those kind of things. But what I wanted to ask you about was you had repeat offenders after 13 years. In the studies, the things we do in Oregon, they talk within 3 years. You find that 13 years give you a much better handle on recidivism?
Well, just to try to be very short in the answer, for this, we also do three-year recidivism rates, too, and that means you can look at people more close in time.
Yeah.
Because for this, we went all the way back to 1990, but this is a long-term investment strategy that we're looking at here. I mean, prison is a long-term investment, so we wanted to know what the long-term effects of some of these investments and programs would be. So we wanted to get as long a perspective as we could. And in Washington right now, we can get 13-year follow-ups. So that's why that's the reason why we looked at that long a term.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ailes, thank you for your testimony. And you said it all when you said how we raise our children will have far more impact on crime than anything we do in our public lives. And I'm going to keep that quote written down and recite it. So thank you. Just a question I have. You mentioned that you made a statement about Washington having too many drug offenders. Can you follow up on that and explain what you meant by that?
Well, as Mike showed there, too many drug offenders in prison. We have a lot more drug offenders in prison than Oregon does. It's just the way our sentencing laws have been put into place by our legislature. We put more drug offenders in prison. And when we do that, we do get reductions in recidivism. But in terms of the kinds of crimes that drug offenders typically do, not all drug offenders, but many drug offenders, they tend to do new drug crimes, which are not as costly to victims or as to us taxpayers as other kinds of violent offenders, for example. So what we find is that the reduction in crime by putting a drug offender in prison has a benefit to cost ratio of about 40 cents of benefit per dollar of cost.
Okay.
So it's less than that. And when we look at some of the options of various kinds of treatment, let's say drug courts, for example, have we done something with that offender in a drug court situation, what we found is that the benefit to cost ratio of drug court, instead of being 40 cents per dollar, is about a dollar or 20 or 30 cents of benefit per dollar of cost. So it's almost four times as effective to treat someone in a drug court setting as that same drug offender in a prison setting. So our legislature has taken that result and has what it decided to do in the 2002 session is it passed a law to shorten the sentences of drug offenders. It did not change how often drug offenders go to prison. That's another policy lever you can pull, but it shortened the sentences of drug offenders that are sentenced to prisons. It took those savings as a result of that, and based on the results here, and it sent those savings to the counties so that they could run drug courts, so that you could trade really a 40-cent resource for a dollar 20 or 30% resource, and that was the procedure.
Could you give us do you know what your percentage of prison population is as a result of property and crime and drug offenders?
It's in a report that I think that Mike and Craig have here.
Perfect.
Could you get that to the staff and distribute it to all of us? Wonderful. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harris, the savings that I see on this slide here appear to be from savings on incarceration costs as a result of achieving the same public safety result through these evidence-based programs. To what extent is Washington State constrained in achieving the shorter time in prison by mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes rules or laws? To what extent is there the latitude to do this, or is there more freedom of action available in Washington State for these issues than we have allowed ourselves here in Oregon?
That red line is a function of the official state forecast in Washington. We have a forecasting agency that produces all the official forecasts, prison, welfare population, school caseloads, and so on. So that it's a joint legislative executive branch thing. So all those sentencing laws that we have in place are a function of those, all of the laws that we have in store. What triggers that is the instance of a crime. A crime has to happen, and then once a crime has to happen, the police have to catch the person and put the person in prison, or send the person to court and have a trial and so on. So what these programs do is they stop that instance of crime happening in the first place. And if that's what happens, because they're not recidivating as much, then the spigot is shut off to the system. The red line is a function of how, once a person gets into the system, how all of the laws that we have in the books affect whether the person goes to prison and how long. But what these programs tend to do, will do, if the evidence indicates, is that they shut off the number of people who do crimes in the first place. Does that make sense? Because that's really what this analysis is all about.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've only got 10 minutes. Could we
could wait till afterwards?
Could I just get it on the record and not ask for a response?
Sure.
I'll just raise it for our staff to keep in mind. My question is, given all the information that we've received today, something to just sort of toss around is, would it save money or be more effective, or both, if we were able to help counties maintain or even expand local jails to house a certain portion of the inmate population rather than depend on state resources for reasons of closer to family, proximity to community services, and so forth, mm-hmm. and not ask for a response today?
That's a good question. I think the trade-off between fidelity and programming versus the social bonding of being close to family is one that should be debated in the literature. Mr. Ayos, thank you very much. We want to make time for our next guest, and we really appreciate you coming all the way down from Olympia today. And while our next presenters are setting up, I will introduce them quickly. With us is Dr. Brian Renauer, who is an associate professor in the Criminology and Criminal Justice Division at Portland State University. He is also the director of the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute, which was codified into Oregon state law with Senate Bill 240 in the summer of 2005. He currently provides research services to a federal weed and seed site in Gresham and worked on Oregon's Project Safe Neighborhoods gun violence reduction effort with the Oregon U.S. Attorney's Office. Also with him is Dr. Annette Jolin, who is chair of the Criminology and Criminal Justice Division at the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University, a position she's held since 2001. Dr. Jolin has had a distinguished career in law enforcement. She actually graduated from what was then the Oregon Police Academy in 1973, along with a new recruit named Jeff Barker. She served as a police patrol officer with the Portland Police Bureau from 1973 to 1979 and was later an instructor at the academy now known as DPSST from 1980 to 1986. So, Dr. Renauer and Dr. Jolin, thank you for coming. And just to set the stage, this is not really their area of expertise, but kind of in the last week or so, I thought, well, could you poke around and find out what some other states are doing on sentencing issues and just report to us on what you find?
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and hi, Jeff. So, my name is Annette Jolin, and I've already been introduced. I wanted to just let you know that we thank you for the opportunity, and I know it's very late. We have 6 minutes, including answers to questions that you might have. We'll give you a very brief review, summary review of a couple of states' sentencing policies and sentencing laws, and people have alluded to in previous presentations as sentencing policies also driving and affecting incarceration rates and the need for incarceration. So we are going to talk about Minnesota and Washington. So this is one piece of Washington that you haven't heard, but Mr. Ayos has alluded to. And what you have in front of you, I just wanted to point out, you have the policies of Minnesota and the policies of the state of Washington, sentencing policies, law in one case, policy in the other, and then a copy of the short presentation that my colleague, Dr. Renauer, and I put together, and I'm going to turn it over to him, and he's going to talk to you about that.
Hi, thank you for having us again. This document provides a very brief summary description of the sentencing practices in Minnesota and Washington, with a particular emphasis on how the minimum sentence served is determined in those two states. At the end of the document, I also included three slides that provide just some contextual information on incarceration characteristics of these two states and also Oregon, and some demographic characteristics and recidivism characteristics I pulled from some reports. Also, some important contextual information is all three of these states share a similar base sentencing characteristics. That is, all three states have a determinate sentencing system. They abolished parole boards. All three states also use presumptive sentencing guidelines. But to start with Minnesota, on page 2 of the handout, in 1993, they passed the legislature passed a statute, Chapter 244-101, which created what I would call sort of almost an automatic good time provision, if you will, for all prisoners entering into the Minnesota prison system, with a couple of exceptions to that. And that is the sentence that is meted out in court. They take two-thirds of that sentence becomes the actual amount of time you serve in prison. The remaining third of that sentence is carried out under supervised release in the community. Disciplinary offenses, however, within prison can increase that amount of time served. So very different to how other states determine minimum sentence length once somebody is in prison by sort of calculating every day of good time. Here they automatically reduce your sentence by two-thirds, but have the possibility of adding time to that. The exceptions to this are some weapons offenses and mandatory life imprisonment. In Washington State, the Department of Corrections established a new a policy to determine minimum length of stay in their prison system. As far as I can tell, I wasn't able to discern how the legislature figured into the development of this policy and the types of discussions that may have occurred there. But all of you have been distributed sort of this internal policy document by Washington DOC. And essentially they create an earned release time by looking at both good time conduct within prison and also earned time credits based upon participation in approved programs, including work in school. The earned release time, there's sort of three categories of eligibility. Some offenders can reduce their sentence by only 10%, some can reduce it by 33%, and some potentially could reduce their sentence by 50%. And on the back side of that page for the Washington State, there's a little table summarizing this. Class A felonies for serious violent or sex offenses, their ERT may not exceed 10% of the sentence handed out in court. Offenders who are classified as lower risk or harm done, so all their prisoners go through an official risk assessment process, those offenders could be eligible up to 50% ERT. There are numerous exceptions to that. Those that their current convictions or have a prior conviction for those eight offenses listed there would not be eligible for a 50% ERT reduction. And my sense is that would be a large group of their prisoners would not be eligible for this 50% reduction in sentence, and it would be only a small group of offenders. Then all the remaining cases, their ERT may not exceed 33% of their sentence. In both the cases of Minnesota and Washington, I was not able to find any sort of rigorous study of the impact of these different sentencing guidelines on their state incarceration rates or public safety types of outcomes. And in terms of Washington, this is a pretty new policy for them. And that would sort of conclude my brief review of these two states.
Any questions?
Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I think the recidivism rate information would be very useful for future research. And if you get any of that, that would be very helpful, I think, to get into this process.
And I know that the Department of the Oregon Department of Corrections has done some research on that, so maybe we can have them present if you like.
Do you want to point to the page?
We do list some numbers in the back just to compare recidivism rates across the three states based on reports that I could find. but those reports don't necessarily examine change in recidivism based on these new policies controlling for other factors.
Great. Any other questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The earned release time in Washington State, credits based on participation in approved programs, would those be programs delivered in prison exclusively or not necessarily?
My sense is that it would be both, that it's both programs within the prison setting, but one of the persons I talked to in the legislature there mentioned that in some cases they have some work release types of programs that they could actually even get out earlier under a more intensive sort of work release program.
Be interested to see a comparative listing of the kinds of programs we have available in Oregon institutions compared to Washington or Minnesota. What kinds of coursework, if you will, or skills we're able to provide to people?
Well, in March, we're going to have a focus on recidivism and how to reduce it, so maybe we can bring that in.
Great
at that
time.
Point. Yeah. Dr. Renauer, I wanted to ask you on the one where it has the incarceration rates for Minnesota, Washington, and Oregon, it says Minnesota has an incarceration rate of about 180 per 100,000, Washington 273, and Oregon 365. Do we have any sense, or Michael, do you have any sense of how, you know, if we've got a significantly higher incarceration rate, are the crime rates significantly different in those states?
I think the crime. Oh, I have a. Hold on a second.
I know that with the CJC report that was just given illustrates that, at least in terms of Oregon and Washington, both violent and property crime rates have trended almost mirror images of one another over the past 20 some years.
Okay. Thank you.
I do have some crime rate information here that didn't make it onto the table. Minnesota has, for example, 268 per 100,000 violent offenders, crimes in 2002, Washington 345, and Oregon 292. So Oregon has the lowest number of violent crimes, has the lowest crime rate of violent offenses. And then Minnesota has the lowest overall index, and this is uniform crime reports, crimes reported to the police information per 100,000. So there are some differences between those states. If you want me to, I could send that to you in a separate
That'd be great.
Cover. Okay.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
The committee is adjourned. Thanks.